And now, a warrior for the Word of God and the Constitution of the United States, a Marine Corps veteran, a Harvard-trained attorney, Bishop of the Call Churches, and founder and president of STAND. Staying true to America's national destiny, the voice of the awakening. Your host, Bishop E.W. Jackson.
And I am he with the awakening, providing for you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. There's a little lack of that going around these days, and we thought here at American Family Radio, we would make sure we give you a great big old walloping dose of it, you know, because we desperately need it right now. Because facts, truth, simply are out the window. They must yield to feelings. They must yield to emotions. They must yield to sensibilities. And don't let the truth get in the way. The problem is that liberals lie and people die. That's right, folks. Liberals lie and people die. But before I get all off into that, I just want to say hello to everybody and so glad to be with you again today. Hope you all are having a great day. And look, I'm still feeling great. I really am. I'm going to get into the Supreme Court decision yesterday that came down. I didn't get into it yesterday because I didn't even really want to look at it. I glanced at it, saw which way it went, and just I didn't even want to look at it. So today, we are going to get into it today. But I'll tell you something. I have not lost heart, not one bit, because I think there's a way out of this and out of these terrible Supreme Court decisions, by the way. It will just take enough of us to get it done, but it can be done. It's been done before, and we'll get into that as well. Let's see. What did I want to talk to? Oh, yes. Don't forget our blogs, okay? Don't forget our blogs. Why do I say blogs? Well, the blog, too. The blog is Stand. But don't forget our podcasts, because the radio program, mine and others, are on AFR.net in the form of podcasts, and they go up usually within a few hours after the program is done. So that if you know somebody who really needs to hear a particular program or part of a program, or they just need to hear it because you think they'll like it, then by all means, tell them, well, look, you don't have to have listened to it while it was on live. You can go to the website, and it's there. In the podcast, just tell them for my program, click on The Awakening, and then it'll give you a list of all the programming, and you can go and listen to whatever you want. Podcast listening is a very, very important way in which we measure our audience participation. So please don't forget to do that. And here's something I don't think I've ever mentioned, but because I did with Tim and the team, Walker and all those guys, and I heard him talking about the app, and I realized, you know, I don't think I've ever talked about the app. You can get the American Family Radio app, and that way you can listen to the programming on your phone easily. I've always thought of, you know, just going to the website, but you get the app on your phone, and the programming is right there. So please, if you don't have the app on your phone, by all means, get the AFR app on your iPhone or your Android or whatever you have, assuming that you've got a relatively up-to-date phone. And if you don't, just go out and get a relatively up-to-date phone so that you can get the app on your telephone. That's very, very important. So that way you can listen to the podcasts and you can listen to the programming as it live streams. I mean, you can just have it at your fingertips, at your disposal. So in your car, you could plug your phone into your speakers in your car and put on the programming and just listen to it with or without any radio station locally that allows you to do that. I mean, you've got us locally wherever you are. I will never forget. In fact, I think it was Walker who, at one of our meetings, somebody said, you know, are you going to build any more radio stations? And his answer was, yes, we do plan to do that at some point. We're always looking for those opportunities. But he said, but guess what? We've got radio for stations all over America. And he held up his phone and said, in your own hand. And that's true, folks. Now, the radio station will follow you wherever you are. So please don't forget that. Don't forget our podcast. Don't forget to use our app. Now, so let's see. Do I have time? Yeah, I have time to get into this a little bit. I posted something on my Facebook page. I went back and looked at it. It did sound pretty angry because I am pretty angry. And I'll tell you, I don't know Neil Gorsuch personally, but I supported his nomination. I supported his confirmation. I was glad to see him be on the court. And now I regret all of that. I said, well, he may make some good decisions. Well, maybe he will. And I trust that he will. But this one is particularly bad. I mean, it is really, really bad. Because the implications of this decision that he made it's called, let me make sure I got the Bostock versus Clayton County, Georgia. Bostock versus Clayton County, Georgia. It is an abominable decision, folks, because what he basically says is he redefines the word sex in the 1964 Civil Rights Act to mean not gender, which is what we've always understood it to mean. Now it means gender identity. Literally, gender identity, which means a person wakes up today and they feel like a man, but they're actually a woman physiologically and biologically. They go to work today dressed as a man, and they're dealing with customers who dealt with them yesterday as a woman, and the boss pulls them aside and says, Sally, oh no, it's Sam today. Well, Sam, Sally, Salam, or whatever, you know, you can't switch genders like that because it confuses the customers, it confuses your fellow workers, it confuses everybody, and you just can't do it. It brings disorder into the workplace. You're discriminating against me. And so, no, I'm not trying to discriminate against you. I'm just trying to maintain some sort of decency and order in the workplace and not have this kind of distraction. No, you're trying to discriminate against me. So then the next day, Sally comes in. Well, hello. Wait a minute. Yesterday you were Sam. Well, that was yesterday. Today I'm Sally. So, you know, with a flowing dress on. Well, Sally, see, this is a little bit of a problem because yesterday you were Sam. Well, that was yesterday. Well, who are you going to be tomorrow? I don't know. I won't find out until I get my, I have to get my gender orientation together in the morning when I get up. I'm, you know, that may sound facetious, but folks, there is this thing called gender fluidity where people actually switch back and forth. They call themselves, well, I guess non-binary is something different. That's where you're neither male nor female. Try that one on for size. You're neither male nor female. And now any business. In fact, I can see this getting expanded beyond that to the point where any person who is dealing with someone who is suffering from gender dysphoria and is not getting treated and trying to return to a state of normalcy as their original biological gender, and you in some way say, well, I don't want to do business with you because that's confusing to me. It's confusing to our children. It's off-putting. And you know what? You're a bigot. You're a hater. You could be sued. That's what Neil Gorsuch, of course, John Roberts deserves credit too. But the two of them sided with the liberals to do that to us. Thanks a lot. Back in a moment.
This is Viewpoints with Kirby Anderson.
The phrase white privilege has been used in the universities for years, but now the phrase is everywhere in our society. But what does it mean exactly? I suspect that more than 95% of the people who use the phrase don't even know where it originated, nor what it was trying to convey. Professor Peggy McIntosh at Wellesley College wrote a paper back in 1988 about male privilege and white privilege. As a feminist author, she argued that men don't recognize male privilege and then expanded it to argue that whites don't recognize white privilege. In one PragerU video, Brandon Tatum, who is African-American, says he hasn't faced the discrimination that is often cited by liberal activists. But he does acknowledge that we do have certain privileges. He says there's two-parent family privilege, there's born-in-America privilege, there's good gene privilege. So yes, some people do enjoy privileges because of their family background or merely because they were born in the U.S. But another way to look at this is to go back to the list created by Professor McIntosh of 26 different examples of privilege she created a third of a century ago. Has some of that improved? Number 5 says, I can turn on the television or open to the front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented. Today I can turn on lots of TV programs and news programs and see a great deal of racial diversity. Brandon Tatum in his video mentions number 26, which says, I can choose blemish cover or bandages and flesh cover that have more or less matched my skin. Go to a drugstore and see if that's still a problem today. I encourage you to look at the list. Some of the privileges still exist, and that is part of the reality of the world, but I suspect you will notice that more than 3 decades later, much has improved. I'm Kirby Anderson, and that's my point of view.
Take Kirby and the Point of View team with you on the go with the Point of View app. Search for Point of View Radio at the Apple or Google Play stores.
Well, these are certainly tough, tough times, aren't they? Hi, it's Michael Woolworth with Bible League International, engaging the world with God's Word for more than 80 years at only $5 a Bible. You know, I'm grateful that God has given Bible League a platform for more than 8 decades to address the other pandemic, and that's the shortage of Bibles all over the world in places like Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America. In fact, at Bible League, we determined that as few as 1 Christian in 10 has a Bible. What's that mean? That during this pandemic, many evangelical Christians elsewhere in the world cannot open their Bible and be reminded of God's promises, like 1 Peter 5:7, cast your cares on Him, for He cares for you. But you know, during this time of sheltering in place, we can shelter in grace. Learn how you can be a blessing to believers around the world praying for a Bible by visiting sendbiblesnow.org. That's sendbiblesnow.org, or by calling Bible League at 800-YES-WORD, 800-YES-WORD.
Brian Fisher here. The Supreme Court issues a horrible, no good, very bad ruling on sexual deviancy, what it means for religious liberty in America. Does Donald Trump understand the dangers of the gay agenda? Mayor de Blasio locks up a religious cemetery but lets transgenders roam free. And the NFL is begging somebody to sign Colin Kaepernick. Next on Focal Point.
Back to the Awakening with Bishop E.W. Jackson on American Family Radio.
You know, the first time I read Roe v. Wade, I was a college student at the time. And I wasn't particularly, at that point, I wasn't particularly ideologically well-formed. I didn't have a well-formed world view. But I can tell you what my impression was on reading Roe v. Wade, that it was gobbledygook. Even as a college student, I thought, like, it didn't make any sense at all. And that the justices were just making stuff up. And I thought the law was supposed to have reference to some fixed principle, idea. And instead, they were just pulling stuff out of whole cloth. I mean, just making stuff out of whole cloth and pulling stuff out of their heads. And, you know, the concept of trimesters. Well, where'd that come from? They just made it up. That's all. They just made it up. And, you know, I get the same impression on this case. Bostock versus Clayton County, Georgia. They're just making stuff up. And by the way, it doesn't make a bit of sense. Not a bit of sense. Just listen to some of this and you'll get what I mean. I think whatever reasoning they claim to be using, it absolutely amounts to nothing. It is just icing on the cake just to make it look good. But if you cut underneath it and you realize there's nothing there. So they say the employers contend that few in 1964 would have expected Title VII to apply to discrimination against homosexual and transgender persons. But legislative history has no bearing here, where no ambiguity exists about how Title VII's terms apply to the facts. Now, what does that even mean? What does that even mean? What the employers are saying is, how in the world can you impose that meaning on the text when everybody knows that in 1964, there's no way in the world that anybody was thinking of gender identity, homosexuality, lesbianism, transgenderism? So the court's now saying, well, that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. And listen to this little tidbit. They, meaning the employers, seem to say that when a new application is both unexpected and important, even if it is clearly commanded by existing law, well, then who says this is clearly commanded by existing law? The court should merely point out the question, refer the subject back to Congress, and decline to enforce the law's plain terms in the meantime. The law's plain terms. You see what I'm saying? That's what the debate is about. It is not the plain terms of the law. In fact, just the opposite. Everybody knows that it referred to biological gender and bans discrimination on that basis, not to the various weird ideas and ghosts of various gender identities running around in somebody's sick head. Everybody knows that that's what the text meant. But they're trying to pretend now, oh, no, the plain meaning of the text clearly includes this. What a disappointment. What a disappointment. Here's what Alito wrote. And I always love Alito's writing. He says, the court tries to convince readers that it is merely enforcing the terms of the statute. But that is preposterous. Even as understood today, the concept of discrimination because of sex is different from discrimination because of sexual orientation or gender identity. And in any event, our duty is to interpret statutory terms to mean what they convey to reasonable people at the time they were written. That I understand. That makes sense. It's straightforward. It's easy to grasp. But this gobbledygook that Gorsuch wrote, I don't even know what he's talking about. To me, it's just doublespeak. And in that sense, it reminds me of Roe v. Wade. And you know what that tells me? Whenever these justices, these leftist justices, and unfortunately, Gorsuch apparently falls into that category, at least in this particular case, whenever they decide they're going to do something, they have to twist themselves into pretzels to make it work. Because plain, straightforward logic won't allow them to do it. So they basically make up stuff. And you read it and you go, well, I thought I was a reasonably intelligent person. That doesn't make any sense to me. And you know what? Well, you're not enlightened enough. Yeah, you just haven't reached the point of enlightenment where you can get it. You know, I've often said, I did graduate from Harvard Law School, but I did not drink that Kool-Aid. Whew, and am I glad I didn't? I mean, think of the people they messed up. Barack Obama. Of course, he was already messed up when he got there, frankly. Neil Gorsuch, now we're finding out. Justice Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts, we're finding out. All got messed up there. Because these schools are no longer schools teaching analysis, the accumulation of facts and information. They're now schools of indoctrination. They're teaching you to think a certain way. In fact, one of my professors was Stephen Greenbrier. Stephen Breyer. I don't even remember what I took from him. I can't remember what the course was, but he was definitely one of my professors. You know, seemed a perfectly nice guy, but just as far out in the left wing as you could get. And I realized that even at the time. And I did not even then, in my first year of law school, have a particularly well-formed worldview. I got saved in the middle of my second year of law school. So right smack in the middle of my law school career, I got saved. And the last year and a half was when I started to awaken to the fact that the worldview being propounded by Harvard Law School and the entire Harvard institution was inconsistent with the worldview taught by the Bible. I took courses at Harvard Divinity School, and I clashed with my professors. I clashed because what I found out was I thought I was going there to learn about the Bible, and what I found out was that Harvard Divinity School was wholly steeped in teaching its students that the Bible was not true. I'm serious, folks. I am not exaggerating. That the whole philosophy of the Divinity School was to make sure that when you left Divinity School, you left with the understanding that the Bible is not true. And you can just kind of make up whatever you want, create your own theology. I don't know whether I ever told you all this. We're getting a little bit far afield, but this is worth noting. Shortly after I left the Harvard Divinity School, which is why I didn't finish Divinity School at Harvard, because I just found it was so inconsistent with what I believed that what was the point? I heard some stuff there that particularly, I was a relatively new Christian when I started taking these classes, but you know what it did? It really strengthened my faith and my convictions, because I would leave class sometimes shaken to the core by some of the crazy stuff that professors tried to teach you. And I would go back and start searching the scripture and realize, wait a minute, do I have to believe them? Or do I believe them? Or do I believe the Bible? I believe the Bible. And then I would go back loaded for bear. And when the subject came up again, I was ready. And I started to get on some of my professors' nerves because I just wasn't buying it. I wasn't buying the stuff that they were handing out. Well, shortly after I left, I got a call from, if I'm not mistaken, some of my classmates or people that I knew who were still there, who asked me to come over and help them because they were having a big battle with the administration. There were still a few Bible-believing Christians there at that time. In fact, I didn't meet a whole lot of them. Most of them went, you know, completely off the rails. But when I went over, I found that they had a display. And folks, I know this is going to sound like you got to be making this up, but I'm not making it up. They had an artistic display, and I don't know how many children would be listening. This is not vulgar, but it's you know, it is what it is. In the lobby of Harvard Divinity School, and the display was called Sacred Condoms. And what they did was some artist took these things and turned them all into religious icons and made a giant structure in the lobby of Harvard Divinity School of them, you know, crucifixes and, you know, little replicas of Jesus. Yeah, that, folks, I know. Well, first of all, who would be stupid enough to spend their time doing something blasphemous like that? Yeah, well, I don't remember who the artist was, but. And then who in the Harvard Divinity School administration would be stupid enough to let them put that unholy garbage in the lobby of the Divinity School? But they did. And this is what people are sending their children off to. This is what they're sending. They're sending their children into an abomination to learn. And what they're doing, what they're actually having happened is the children are being drawn into an ungodly cult in which they leave with absolutely no biblical values or worldview whatsoever. Is that all they have is the wicked imaginations of their own mind, because after all, they're intellectual, right? And they've graduated from Harvard, right? And so what, in fact, folks, this is the absolute truth. I was talking to one of the students there one time. We had just come out of a class, if I'm not mistaken. And we were talking about, because I had to preach, I was going to be a guest speaker somewhere. And I said, I got to go home. I said, I got to pray and study and you know, try to hear from the Lord what he wants me to say. And the person said to me, what do you need to do that for? That's what we're here for. They can tell us that. And I thought to myself, oh, brother, really? So, thank you, Neil Gorsuch. Appreciate it. Back in a moment.
It's my turn.
Here is your host for My Turn, Don Wildman.
The carpenter from Nazareth had about him some very definite human qualities, for the very simple reason that he was very definitely a human. Two of those qualities stand out. Without them, life can hardly be worth the effort of living. The first quality which the Galilean had, and which we need, is that in every bad situation, he saw some good. Things must never get so dark that we cannot still see the light needed for living. It was a bad situation that Christ saw the tax collector Matthew in, but Jesus saw the good in Matthew the man. It was a bad situation when Peter ran out on his Lord, but Jesus saw the good in Peter, even the faithfulness and steadfastness. Jesus even nicknamed him the Rock. The cross was a bad situation, man's highest contempt for God, but Jesus saw the good which could come from it. The second quality of Jesus which you and I need is this. In every problem, he saw a possibility. In every problem he faced, Jesus sought and found some possibility through which he could bring honor to his Father. Faced with the problem of traveling through Samaria, a country avoided by the Jews, he used the occasion for the possibility of revealing who he was to a sinful Samaritan woman at Jacob's well. Faced with the problem of worried disciples on the Sea of Galilee in a storm, he found the possibility to show the power and concern of God. The secret here is that we strive to be like Christ. In every bad situation, we need to look for the good. If we look for the good, we will find it. If we look for the bad or look to find fault, we'll find that. Thoreau Harris once wrote, "Look for the beautiful, seek to find the true." No person can honestly call himself a follower of the Galilean who continually looks only for what is wrong. Jesus was a positive person who believed in the power and the goodness and the concern of God. He believed in a God who could and would help in every situation. We also need to look for the possibilities in every problem. John Wesley, with the church doors of England closed to him, turned reluctantly to preaching in the open air. It opened a whole new, exciting, and extremely rewarding way of life to him. There's an old saying which contains much truth. Every adversity hides a possibility. We can actually turn bad problems into good possibilities. Pilgrim's Progress was written in Bedford Jail, where John Bunyan was a prisoner because he preached religious toleration and freedom. The famous preacher Charles Spurgeon once said that many men owe the grandeur of their lives to their tremendous difficulties. Occasionally, when our vision is blurred by problems, we cannot see sights which at other times are so clear. When this happens, we need more than ever to remember that the oyster turns into pearl the sand which annoys it. In every bad situation, look for the good. In every problem, seek the possibility. If you'll do these things, they will help you live and love it.
This has been My Turn with Don Wildman, a production of the American Family Association.
Back to The Awakening with Bishop E.W. Jackson on American Family Radio.
Let's see if we can get one or two calls in this segment. 888-589-8840. That's 1-888-589-8840. Let me share a little information with you all as you're getting lined up, because we got open lines right now. This is from the Bureau of Justice Statistics as well, and it's confirmed, by the way, by the Washington Post, which has their own database. There's another organization that also provides this information. I'll find that. They've got it on the website. They don't compile it. They just give you the incidents of police killings. Since 2015, 5,595 people have died at the hands of police officers since 2015. That's over the last 5 years. 2,473 have been white. 1,296 have been black. So that's 23%. 902 have been Hispanic. And 737 have been other or unknown. In other words, other ethnicities, or they couldn't be identified in terms of their their racial classification. 23% black, 1,296, 2,473 whites, which is almost 50%, about 46, 47%. So that means, as I've said before, the ratio of black to white people who are killed in confrontations with police annually is about 2 to 1. Why don't we ever hear that? Why don't we ever see in the news what happens when a police officer ends up killing a person who happens not to be black? Could that be because there's a narrative in which that's irrelevant? 77%, therefore, of the people who are killed at the hands of police are not black. And by the way, what about them? Isn't this one of those circumstances where we ought to be saying all lives matter? The average number of black people killed at the hands of police each year is about 250. The average number of white people killed at the hands of police each year is close to 500. 2 to 1. Now, the question then becomes, for me, I want to know every time a police officer kills a white person. I want to know that. I mean, if we've really got a problem with police brutality, why is it only about black people? Why shouldn't it be about everybody? If there really is a problem, and if white people are dying 2 to 1, isn't that relevant? Well, we know that's a rhetorical question because in today's culture, it's really not, is it? How about this? I'd like to know every time a police officer saves a black person's life. Whoa, now wait a minute, EW. Now you're really going off the rails now. Oh my goodness. You actually want to know the positive things that police officers do to save people's lives, and particularly when they save or help black people? Yeah, I'd like to know that. Sure. I think I'd like to know that. Oh, yeah, well, see, now that just goes to show. You. Oh, Bishop Jackson, you're so far off. You're so far gone, you just don't even know it. Because we all know, right, that police officers don't do anything positive to help people, right? I mean, we all know that. So why are you even bringing that up? That's so off the wall. And here's the other thing I'd like to know. I'd like to see stories written every time a black person kills a police officer. How about that? Because you know, don't you, that I think 45 police officers were killed in 2019. You know, don't you, that the overwhelming majority of them are killed by black people. Now, I know we're not allowed to say that. Because what we're not allowed to do is address the issue of crime in the black community, which is primarily affecting black people. We're not allowed to address that. Because we just want to go along with that, like that's not even happening. And we just want, because after all, that doesn't help the revolution, does it? Right? That doesn't really help the revolution. But those are the facts. And when we get to a point in our culture where facts and truth don't matter, you know what? I'm going to keep putting the truth out there like throwing meat at a bear. And I believe there are people who want the truth who will say, that's what I want to hear. I want to know the facts of the matter. I want to know the truth of the matter. I don't want to know some left-wing propaganda or right-wing propaganda. I want to know the truth. Let's see. Let me mention a couple of other things. Let's see. I've got time to get a couple of calls in. Boy, I thank God. In fact, there's a story today that I saw in Breitbart about a deputy who becomes a girl's godfather because he saved this girl's life. He stopped the woman. She was actually in crisis because the baby had stopped breathing. And I guess she got the police officer to respond, and he got in there and got that baby and performed CPR on that baby and saved that baby's life. And she asked him to be godfather. It just so happens here again. Don't you long for the day when it's no longer relevant? It just so happens that he's white and the woman and her baby are black. But who cares in the end? It's one human being blessing and helping another human being. How about more stories about that? Yeah, well, we can't tell those stories because they don't feed into the revolution. You see about the black guy carrying an American flag in the autonomous zone, how they cursed him out and called him a race traitor and ran him out and tried to take the flag from him, all of that. Oh, but it's not about the flag. It's not about disrespecting the flag. No, it's not about that. Oh, just stop lying. It is about that. Colin Kaepernick knows it's about that, and everybody else knows it's about that. It's about delegitimizing and disrespecting and dishonoring our country as a bad place. I keep saying I don't know why they don't leave, but so far they are not taking me up on my invitation. Oh, I could go on. The number is 888-589-8840. Let's go to your calls and see what you all are thinking about today, because it just, the situation just gets crazier and crazier. Let's see. Let's go to Lee in Virginia. Lee, welcome.
Yes, sir. Bishop Jackson, listen to you every day. Thank God for you and your ministry. Got like 2 points I'd like to make real fast. One, the Romans 1 talks about a people or a nation that knew God. Then they forsook God. And the Bible says, you know, they came wise in their own eyes. It says, Professing themselves to be wise, they became as fools. That's our Supreme Court. They can't make a rational decision, or neither can our government, hardly. They think they're so wise, but in God's eyes, they're fools. And I got one more thing, and I'd like to see if you could research this a little bit. There is one Confederate general, they will not tear his statue down. And I've been told he's the only Confederate soldier statue left in Washington, D.C. And you know who it is?
Who?
His name is Albert Pike. He wrote the dogma and the doctrines for the Masonic Lodge. They will never tear his statue down because he started the Masonic Lodge. And all your Supreme Court judges as a whole, your congressmen and your presidents are Masons. They will never pull Albert Pike's statue down.
That's interesting, Lee. Listen, Lee, thanks for the call. I will take a look at that. You all stand by. I'll come to you after the break. Look, we know it's ultimately, though, not about the Confederate statues, don't we? I mean, we know that's not what it's ultimately about. If that were all it was about, you could have a rational discussion. You know, I said yesterday, I found out that some of these generals, of course, you know, they were bad generals on both sides, but some of these generals on the Confederate side, even the Confederates didn't like them. They didn't admire them. But I think in the way of trying to peace and reconciliation, they basically lionized some of these people as courageous, and in some cases they weren't. You could have a discussion about that. But that's not what they want, is it? Back in a moment.
One of the things I always applaud my parents for and thank God every day is that they dared me to dream.
He was born at 26 weeks and told he may never walk or talk, but his parents never stopped believing in him. This is Focus on the Family Minute. Dr. Tyler Sexton describes how his parents encouraged him even in the midst of his limitations.
There were things that if I wanted to be a basketball player, they said, sure, you know, you're going to do it. You're going to have the nicest shoes you can do, and you may not be able to run back and forth. We're going to play half court. Or, you know, hey, if he wants to try certain things, we're going to try to make that happen and make it as good as we possibly can and enjoy what we can. And so they dared me to dream and reach for the moon. And that's really what's been impacted on me my entire life, because it's allowed me to say, you know what, I can do this.
As a parent, you can encourage your child despite whatever limitations they may seem to have. Hear more of Tyler's inspiring story at FamilyMinute.org.
Hello, I'm Franklin Graham. Right now, our country is in trouble, and people are scared, people are afraid, and we see the violence and the injustices that are taking place. Only God can change this. This is a problem of the human heart.
If you'd like to pray with someone, call us any time of the day or night at 888-388-2683. 888-388-2683.
Call that number right now. We've got someone who will pray with you, talk with you, encourage you. God bless.
This Sunday is Father's Day, and this weekend on Encouragement Live, we'll focus on the role of fathers in uncertain times. This is Don Hawkins. Dr. Greg and Aaron Smalley of Focus on the Family join me to address the challenges and opportunities fathers face in these difficult times. Plan to join us for Encouragement Live, Saturday at 7:05 p.m. Central, 8:05 Eastern, here on American Family Radio.
We are not allowed to have a U-Haul that comes to heaven with us.
Anna Marie Travers has an AFA Foundation charitable gift annuity.
The Lord has given us things that we can acquire, but you know, everything will stay here. And I'm so thankful for the American Family Annuity Fund, where we can give some to something that we so highly value.
Through the AFA Foundation, a charitable gift annuity provides a monthly income as well as a legacy of support for the American Family Association.
I cannot recommend a better person than they have at AFA to help you with getting your annuity fund. It was so easy.
Call the AFA Foundation today to find out how you can set up a charitable gift annuity. Just call 800-326-4543, extension 345.
Back to the Awakening with Bishop E.W. Jackson on American Family Radio.
Well, I don't know whether the statue of Albert Pike will be removed, but he's right. Albert Pike is a prominent Freemason, and he does have a statue in Judiciary Square in Washington, D.C. Eleanor Holmes Norton has called for it to be torn down, but so far it's still there. So we shall see, shall we? We shall see. You all are the most interesting people in the world. I mean, I learn all kinds of things from you all. Let's see. Let's go to the next caller or question. Let's go to Dean in Oklahoma. Dean, welcome. Dean, are you there?
Yes. Hello?
Yes, I'm here. You're on.
Thanks for taking my call. I got a question about the decision, the Supreme Court decision. Is there any way to appeal that, overturn it?
Dean, I'm glad you raised the question, because there's only one way to overturn it. Of course, the Supreme Court in years to come could have a change of heart and decide that the reasoning was wrong, or they could, you know, it's rare that it happens, but it could. But the way the people could overturn it is we'd have to pass a constitutional amendment that defines what gender is under our Constitution and our rule of law, and then we could do marriage as well. See, I think we made a strategic mistake. We, meaning the conservative movement, made a strategic mistake when we decided not to go for a federal constitutional amendment, but to go for state amendments. Because as you saw, the Supreme Court just went in and just wiped those out in one fell swoop. So that's the only avenue of appeal we have right now.
Yeah, and I just have a comment. It's been on my mind these last few weeks of the adversary has laid in wait for years and years and years, while the population of this country has forgotten, with raising children and generations, has forgotten what sacrifice is. The men and women that died and fought in war to sacrifice for this country, we're into generations now that don't know what that means and don't have it in their heart. And it's sad. It's sad.
It is. It is, Dean. You're right. I mean, you see that from the response that Drew Brees got when he didn't talk against people. He basically just said, look, When I think of the sacrifice my grandfathers made, it moves my heart, and I would never disrespect the flag, and I can't agree with anybody who does. And they went after him with all guns blazing, and it was absolutely no holds barred. They didn't say, well, you know, we understand your respect for your grandfather. Oh, no. You're a racist and a bigot, and you're insensitive, and you ought to know better. So you're right. You can't have respect for those who sacrificed and went before us anymore. That's not acceptable. So thank you for the call. Let's go to Jerome in Texas. Jerome, welcome.
Yes, good afternoon, Bishop. Thank God, I love listening to your perspectives every day and your wisdom. I just wanted to mention about the LGBTQA.
Yeah.
And my concern is now that they have extended the legislative language to include all those categories, at what point are we going to have to be concerned about pedophilia being added to that? I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, Jerome, thank you. Look, I think it's unavoidable. Once you say that sex means sexual orientation, and I've read numerous articles now. In fact, the New York Times had to kind of back off one that they published, saying basically that pedophilia is a sexual orientation and there's nothing wrong with it as long as people don't take advantage of children. But then there's another argument that children are in a position to give their consent in some cases, and you have to consider that as well, not restrict the child's ability to give sexual consent. That's the sickness that this stuff leads to. Because, look, sin knows no bounds, does it? I mean, it never gets enough. And who would have thought that, because, by the way, you know one of the things that this decision impacts? It impacts drag queen story time. Because the library says now, well, you know, we can't do it because, you know, parents really don't want a transgender, transvestite, you know, having access to their children that way. That's now discrimination. If you wouldn't say that about a heterosexual, you can't say that about a transgender. That's the craziness that Gorsuch and Roberts have forced on us. I named them because we know what the liberals were going to do. I mean, nobody's surprised about that. But those two, oh, but thanks for the call. And you're right. It's the impact is going to take us some places we never thought we would go, just as has happened again and again and again. Let's go to Dick in North Carolina. Dick, welcome.
Thank you, Bishop. Jerome made half my point just now. I was thinking about a man who spent time in Hooskow for being a sexual predator, a homosexual pedophile, or a pedophile in general, and then wanting a job as a daycare. I don't know how this in a daycare. I don't know how this ruling affects that. Or two sides of the coin, where a man who claims to be a woman and wants to get a job at Macy's in the woman's lingerie department, or a woman who's been working there, and she gets up one morning and she decides to dress and act like a man, and she shows up for work. What do they do with her? I'm just throwing them out. I don't know how it's going to work out in the end. I don't think anybody does. And with regard to Colonel Pike, I read in the entirety, Morals and Dogma, the 1871 edition. On page 248, Colonel Pike declares that Lucifer is the god of the lodge. And anybody can check me out on that. I know what I'm talking about.
Well, listen, Dick, thank you for the call. I really do appreciate that. And as to all your questions about how those things will work out, I think the Supreme Court decision now makes the law clear that you would have no recourse. I mean, the person comes in and says, I know I was a man yesterday, I'm a woman today. The only thing you can do is say, well, you know, put on your dress and your high heel shoes and get to work. Because what Neil Gorsuch said, who wrote the opinion, if you cannot make a distinction, say, between, in other words, if you do not complain about a man coming in dressed in man's clothes, you can't complain about a woman who suddenly says she's a man coming in dressed as man's clothes, because if you do that, you are discriminating on the basis of sex. That's their position. That's what they said. So you're right. It is utterly crazy. And as far as daycare programs, who knows where that goes? Who knows where that goes? It's bizarre. It is utterly bizarre. But here again, this is what happens when people reject the law of God. Let's go to Sherry in Oklahoma. Sherry, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is, when I was in college, I did a study on Albert Pike and wrote a paper on him. what the men have previously said is correct. Not only was he a 32nd Freemason, he was also a Grand Wizard for the KKK. And this man
really? Wow, I didn't know that.
Yep. This man was sick. He followed the Luciferian protocols. And he's just a horrible man. It infuriated.
Well, you know what? The left will probably leave his statue up then because, I mean, after all, they're spiritual brothers and sisters.
I hope so. You know? And get rid of that Freemason there at the Capitol.
Yeah.
That building needs to be torn down. Well, anyway, my question is, why don't we call the transgender what they really are? They are multiple personalities. When they say that they're a woman when they're a man and vice versa, this has got to stop. We got to call it for what it is and stop entertaining their sickness.
Well, look, it used to be called gender dysphoria, and they used to try to treat it, but the American Psychological Association gave up all reference to any moral vision, and so now, basically, anybody who comes in and says they're this, it doesn't matter how bizarre it is, that's what they are. I mean, remember the situation on television where somebody asked, well, what if I forget who was doing this interview. I think it was somebody Sean Hannity sent out. But what if I say I'm a 6'5" Asian basketball player, and you're in fact a 5'10" a woman of European descent? And the answer was, well, if that's what you really think you are, then yeah, absolutely, I support that. So I guess you'd have to go to a psychologist, and they would tell you how to adjust to being a 6'5" Asian basketball player, even though you might look like a 5'6" woman of European descent. This stuff is just, it's crazy. And you're right, it is mental illness, but you can't judge. You know, you simply can't judge. And here again, where does that take you when it comes to the treatment of children and predation of people on the basis of sex? I mean, where does that take you? If a person says, well, no, that's my orientation, do you have to say, oh, sorry about that, and then we won't discriminate? You're right. It's just bizarre. Let's go to James in Mississippi. James, welcome. And you're going to be the last one up.
Thank you. I'm calling concerning the push for a national policy on the police reform. And I call my legislatures, and I think that's one of the key things, is everybody's got to call their legislators. I called them and I said, how can you have a policy when you don't have any facts or any information? We need to go to the communities, ask the people, what are the problems? What are the solutions that you see? Then go to the policemen and say, what are the problems? What are the solutions you see? And then come together and say, you know, yes, we can change this and we can do this to make this better and all those things. I was talking
James, I got to go. Thank you for the call. James, what you're saying is absolutely right. If you really think that's going to happen, James, I got a bridge in Brooklyn I want to sell you. The left is not interested in that. They're interested in dictating to people what they want. And that's all there is to it. I mean, they're not interested in a rational discussion to try to make our country better. They hate this country, and they want to bring it down. Well, folks, that's going to do it for us today, but God bless you all. You know what? I don't care how badly they want to bring it down. America's not going down. We're going up, because we cannot be defeated if we will not quit, because we are on God's side.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.